Jamaica. I'm from Jamaica. I am from Jamaica, but I quite delight in saying I am from the hills in Jamaica, is described as Baka Bush. That's mean you get to the bush and then you keep going behind it.
Oh,
I'm from as deeply rural as you can get. And I'm quite proud of that, because everybody that I've met, everywhere I've been, the impression that people have gotten is that I am cosmopolitan, and I am not. I am deeply rural, barefoot running girl is what truly delights me, and is totally what I am from. And it's a long way to be. It's Cascade, Hanover Hills. It's a long way to get to London. And it has been interesting. And it's funny, I'll readily say my heart is still there. But in a way, my heart is also very much in London. So I think I leave pieces of me along the way. Or maybe acquire pieces, depending on how I look at it, as I move through places and life. Yeah, I am... Oh my God, this year I'm 47. I'm old. I ended up in London because I'm LGBT, if I'm going to try to put it in a nutshell. And I ended up in England in the first place because I am, and in London because I'm a refugee. Because when I came to England, I was in Wolverhampton, just outside Birmingham. Mm. And circumstances changed and I moved to London. Following a woman, as you do. And that changed as well, because I, in a lot of ways, we supported each other for a long time. We were together for a long time. So it made life possible with less trouble. So when I was on my own, I needed a stronger support network, and that sort of led me out to find that. And that's when I actually applied for refugee status and all of that malarkey, which essentially changed who I am. The whole refugee process really changed me.
In what way? Do you want to tell me a bit about that?
It made me into an activist, really,
right.
is what it did, because I encountered so many questionable things that just didn't sit good with my spirit, if that makes sense. So I felt I've always written a lot. I write. I share mostly poetry, but I write a lot about just about everything. And I journal a lot. And even the way I journal, when I look back now, changed during that time. And then there was a whole time that I couldn't journal. I applied for asylum I went to the Home Office on the 1st of July 2010 and was incarcerated. It's a general thing to not want to use that word, and they don't want us to use that word because the idea is that you're not in prison. I was in prison.
Mm.
So it's all well and good to say you're not in prison when I have you locked up.
Mm.
I don't know what is the essential difference that's meant to happen there. And I had a really hard time coming to terms with it. At the time when I was locked up, I didn't necessarily react, because I guess I sort of go into operational mode. There are things to do, and so you sort of do. And it's like afterwards that I kind of felt it. But I don't know that I reconciled it necessarily and put it to bed. I just know that I've probably grown a bit. I still don't understand the psychology that how you make it logical to lock somebody up. If I come to you with everything that I've got, my papers and everything, and say, I'm obviously not trying to hide. If I was trying to hide, I wouldn't be here. So if you lock me up to say it's easier to access me, whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do. And when you eventually release that person, you tell them, come in and sign on every week. So obviously, you know they're not going anywhere. So the whole idea of locking somebody up just feels like psychological terror. I cannot see any administrative reason, which are the ones given, that it makes sense. And it damages people and affects how they then move on and how they then become productive citizens. And it's a cycle that I had a hard time dealing with. Currently, I'm running the Safe Space for Women at the LGBT Centre with Mind for Mental Health. So I run a discussion space where people talk, or, well, it's a safe space for women, so it's utilised however LGBT women feel safe to use it.
And it's at Mind?
And it's with Mind, and it's at Outcome in near Archway. And I also do Weather the Storm, which is support for refugees that have been granted. Because what I find is, while support, I mean, support will never be adequate, but there are a number of agencies, organizations that are agitating and are standing together to support asylum seekers, you know, and those difference in political terms, which basically, if you're fleeing persecution, you're a refugee, but you're not legally a refugee, you've not yet acquired a legal status. And there, most of the organizations that are funded, or however they do their work, focus on getting people the status, which then give you the option to actually live. Nobody's looking at how you're living after. Once you're through, it becomes, oh, let us celebrate, this person now needs me. And I found that when I was granted, I don't remember what day of the week it was. It was either a Monday or a Tuesday that I got the letter telling me that I was granted. And my friends planned a party for the Friday. And by the Friday, I'd already broken. They had to cancel the party. I couldn't go.
You'd what?
I had already broken. I'd already crashed, I'd already gone. So the idea that this is great and we're going to celebrate it isn't necessarily how the person who's gotten that information feels. Sometimes that's when the person really, really needs support and really, really needs just a transitional platform that says, I am not alone. And that's when everybody's letting you go. The other thing about that is, when you're granted status, there are no services that are specifically for you. You are now an ersatz British citizen, more or less, and you're meant to utilize the services that are provided for everybody. So you're not competing with the whole nation, which is one part of it, and which is acceptable. But you don't know what services exist, even if you could use them. You don't know, there are people going, oh, I need a job, without realizing that they need an NI number first. And there are a whole raft of things that you now need to do to legitimize you that people don't even realize they have to do until they turn up somewhere to probably say, okay, NAS, which is who supports asylum seekers, is now no longer helping you. So you apply for benefits and you understand, or you're not entitled to benefits until you've sorted NI number. And that's how people keep crashing into things, by trying to do something and then being told what they need to do before. So what we're doing in the group is sort of supporting people into things that they need to do in order to move on, and it's more peer support as well, because, you know, somebody might say, oh, I haven't been able to get benefits, I'm still job hunting. And then somebody else will say, yes, what I did then was I talked to Red Cross, this is a number, and they say, okay, then I have some time tomorrow, meet me and we can go up there together. And I've gotten a lot of that, where it's just finding this space for people to come together and help each other, more so than me necessarily finding help for the person. And that has happened a lot, where, you know, people are literally saying, we can get some help here for you, make the appointment and I will come with you. So people don't feel all alone having to go and talk through these things, when really you can't even get energy to come outside. And it's like, and then what's really hard is trying to get anybody to understand how low you feel then, in this moment that's supposed to be hugely celebratory. It does not feel celebratory at all. And 90% of the people, when they come out the other end, said if they knew, they wouldn't even have applied. But church as well. Church has been huge. I have not mentioned church. How could I not mention church?
Yes.
Church is such a big part of my life. I go to Metropolitan MCC, Community Church, in North London. And it's a fantastic organization. I serve on the board. I've served on the board for a good few years now. But when I went there initially, I don't think I was the only person of color, but close.
Mm.
I probably was the only person, definitely the only vocal person of color. And I like it. There's so many more people there now, and it's lovely. And I kind of think that, because at the time I was doing a lot of that sort of BME thing, when people come, making sure people feel welcome and stuff, and I still do that, but I am really pleased that the demographic has changed hugely now, and it's sort of almost 50-50. And but it's a fantastic place, and religion is just is equally the bane of my life and my greatest joy. it's a place in which I've experienced so much violence and questioning of myself, not physical violence, but so much doctrinal violence against who I am. You know what I mean? So much terrorizing me for being. And at the same time, it's a place in which I've found such comfort and joy, and it's a place in which I've found community, and it's a place in which I have family bonding and community bonding, and so it's always for me such a personal and controversial area of my life. And in a lot of ways, it's like family. Because family is the same thing. Most of the violence I've experienced is, you know, families where I've gotten the most violent interaction about who I am, and at the same time the most validation about my possibilities. So it's that thing. And church is that for me. I never really speak church outside of church, because I believe that church is such a hugely and deeply personal experience. And to get a little bit religious, I believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ, and there isn't a single instance on earth when Jesus took anything to anybody without request.